This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. I met the writer Whitney Terrell last year when we did a series of broadcasts from Kansas City. Now Whitney is turning his writerly skills to work for us. He recently visited Fort Hood, Texas, to say goodbye to a young soldier who is a writer friend, a man making his second deployment to Iraq. And here's a note to consider. Some of what you're going to hear in this story is quite graphic. Here's Whitney Terrell.
In 2006, I embedded with a young Army lieutenant named Nate Rawlings in Baghdad. Nate wanted to be a writer or a filmmaker. But at the time, he was a combat engineer whose job was to search for IEDs or clean up after them.
So we found pieces of the driver. We found his face. We found what was left of his skull. We found...
This is Nate describing a truck bomb that hit a barracks that year.
How do you find somebody's face?
It was actually plastered to the side of a big round pole that was holding up power lines. The force of the explosion, since he was literally sitting on top of the bomb, had torn his face in kind of an angular pattern, so it was sort of two-thirds of his face kind of cut diagonally, with one ear still intact, a big clump of hair.
Is there something that you turn to for solace or hope when you are faced with something like that?
Well, that's where it's a blessing and a curse to be a writer, because you sort of think that anything you're doing now might have some use later on in life. That was the great quote from John Irving from The World According to Garp, was that a novel is a place for everything you can't use in your own life if you're a writer.
Okay, just to be clear, I am a writer, and I have no idea what I'd do if I found a face like that. But when I hear Nate's story, I do think, wow, aren't I the one who's supposed to be quoting John Irving? It's not the first time that I felt like the war has somehow flip-flopped my generation. I'm 40, and Nate's, at least in terms of maturity.
Round town washcloth!
Round town, don't put out no pink towel!
A day after this conversation, which Nate and I have in his apartment just outside Fort Hood, we drive over to the fort itself and visit his company. They're heading back to Iraq for 15 months. And the sergeants, some of whom I patrolled with in 2006, are out advising privates on how to pack. Like Nate, they all look impossibly young. But many of these soldiers are on their third or fourth tour in combat. As for Nate, he'd planned to leave active duty this spring and go to graduate school. But he's been stop-lost. So, like everybody else, he's heading to Baghdad. That means no grad school this or next fall, since he probably won't have time to apply. It also means he's one of the few 26-year-olds in America who's looking forward to his 30s.
My uncle, when he came back from Vietnam and was 25 or 26, told his parents, I want to go to medical school. And I think a few friends told him, you're way too old. You'll be 30 by the time you're going to be a doctor. And my grandfather's response to him was, well, when you turn 30, you're going to turn 30 anyway. And so I will turn 30, hopefully, as a filmmaker, as opposed to, or at least a film school graduate, as opposed to just turning 30 when I turn 30.
All right, before I give the impression that Nate is some kind of incredibly patient saint.
I worked pretty hard when I was sober, which was a good period of the time, at least more than half.
I'd like to point out that at Princeton, which is where he was sober half the time, he lived like a typical college kid. He wrestled, he played rugby. He was an officer in Princeton's version of Animal House, which is an eating club called Tiger Inn.
I was in charge of 200 to 300 extremely intoxicated and people who like to do stupid things.
This part of Nate still exists. He loves a crowd. He's only alone when he comes home to sleep. And it's here, in the shadowy, half-empty apartment Nate rents outside Fort Hood, that I start to notice the ghosts who have come to populate his life in the past 2 years. Like the dozen or so men who died on his last deployment, or his friend from Princeton's rugby team.
I had a friend who I played rugby with in college at Princeton, and he was wounded in an IED strike, I guess about a year ago, and he's been recovering down at the Brook Army Medical Center in San Antonio. If he's still there when I come home from the next tour, I certainly will visit him, but for now, as I'm sort of preparing myself to go back, I have chosen not to.
Do you feel guilty about that?
The one thing I always did fear wasn't death. I mean, if you die, you die. But, you know, being so disfigured that you cannot then function, you just don't want to see too much of what is possible before you have to go, because you know there's a very likely chance you'll see it with yourself, with your men, when you're over there on patrols.
Conversations like these make me wonder just exactly how much the war and this premature introduction to death is going to change Nate, not just as a person, but as the writer or filmmaker he hopes to be. It's like watching a photograph develop before your eyes. He's different, certainly, than the young man who wrote flowery emails back to his Princeton professors, describing moonlight glimmering on the Euphrates when he first arrived in Iraq. In those letters, which I've read, he sounds like a naive college kid off on an adventure. Now his language has grown darker, leaner, more direct. "Before we shipped out," he wrote me toward the end of his first tour, "I talked to my guys' families. Many of the mothers, my own included, admitted that, more than the loss of a son, what scared them most was that their little boy would die alone, scared and in pain." I wait until we're at dinner that evening, however, before I actually bring up my own concerns about Nate.
Because I worry. I'm going to talk about Nate like he's not here. I worry about how this stuff is going to affect him.
We've driven an hour into Austin, Texas, just to have dinner with Nate's best friend, Rob Pellegrini, and Rob's fiancée, Jen. Rob has just returned from Iraq, where his battalion lost close to 20 men.
No, I have not seen very many changes in Nate. And he's an asshole. Oh, are we still talking about like he's not here?
Well, we are here because Rob and Nate trained together. And Nate has told me that if anyone can explain how the war has changed him, Rob's the man.
Hopefully, you know, he was a little jumpy and a little jittery and a little standoffish to society. And I say that because I think Jen's experiencing that with me. Hopefully we're at the tail end of that, but I've snapped a few times and she's been like, "Whoa, there's the couch, buddy."
Okay, so basically Rob doesn't really answer my question. But then something interesting happens. I look across the table at Nate and I can tell he's disappointed in Rob's answer too. Clearly there's something about their relationship that he's trying to get across to me. Then to my surprise, Nate begins to tell me a story about a phone call he made to Rob when he was in New York City.
I was on the subway listening to my iPod, and I remember I got off the subway and I called him, and I was like, is this so enjoyable to walk around New York City, walk around Manhattan, listening to music? It's like I've never walked around New York before.
And here, for the first time, I see Nate respond to the war, to what's happening to him, as a writer or a filmmaker would. Because if you want to get across an emotion in fiction, the best way is to come at it obliquely. Like through a phone call you had about music with your best friend when you were on leave from Iraq.
He said because that allows you to be in a crowd of people and be completely alone and be fine with it. And the whole time I was in Iraq, I thought about him every time I listened to any kind of music. Either if I was absolutely alone or in a crowd of people, if I could pop in the headphones, I felt fine with it. And I took a lot of comfort in that, and that helped get through a lot of the craziness.
And yet, inside this story, this apparently innocuous story, I think if you listen closely, you can hear
to be in a crowd of people and be completely alone.
What it feels like for a soldier like Nate to be around the rest of us, that vast majority of Americans who have not fought this war, even when he does come home. For NPR News, I'm Whitney Terrell.
Whitney's friend, Nate Rawlings, Captain Rawlings, will answer questions about his experience inside our city over the coming months. You can submit yours at npr.org/daytoday.